This is an honorable and historic moment as I welcome the great, at least great in this digital world and of our mind, Dr. Martin Hart of Keystone Total Health. It's an honor and a privilege. I know I've done a lot of smoke blowing before the show, but I do want to echo how lucky we are to have you and your expertise and your wisdom and your energy that you bring not only to this space, but to your office and your patients, and I would say society at large, which needs about 2 million troops of Dr. Hart clones deployed immediately. So welcome.
Thank you so much. I'll get working on the clones. I don't know what the time frame for that one is, but I do feel very blessed and honored to be in this space with you and collaborate with you and your team and to see what shows up. I'm really interested to do this and move forward.
Well, here's the beginning. Well, it's really a continuation because you're no stranger to the show. You're certainly not a guest. You're certainly more of a friend. And now we're driving this bus off the cliff together, my friend. So I really want to say to the people that have kind of followed a lot of the mental rabbit holes that Dr. Shulman and I went down over the years, that I am equally as excited and honored to share this space with you and appreciate your time and your dedication, not only to us, but like I said, to healing in general, because it could not come at a more desperate time. You and I witness the suffering every day, but I really want people to get to know you and know where you're from, what you're about, how you got into this, and why you continue to do what you do, what drives you and sustains you. So that's pretty much our loose outline for the show. And there's a lot about you that in our relationship, whether that's collaborating on patients, that I still don't know. So this is going to be equally as fascinating and entertaining for me because I'm very intrigued to understand why you are the way that you are. you're a young guy. I had to Google you a while back, and I'm not that much older than you, but I was very impressed at your wisdom beyond your years, and I was quite envious of that. Like, wow, wish I'd had my crap half together even 10 years ago as you do now. And to me, that tells a fabulous story. And I know that for you to get where you are now in life and career and family and faith and all of the things that you bring to the world, you have a fascinating story. And so I want to make this mostly about you. Let's start with where you're from. Are you from planet Earth, and can you prove it? Do you have a birth certificate to actually prove that you come from this planet?
You know, I can't for sure say, I suppose. I don't remember being born here, but someone did hand me one when I turned 18 and said, hey, you might need this useful. So as far as I can tell, I'm from the Earth, but I do have some pet theories about viral DNA and meteors and human species. But I guess from here, we could say I'm from Earth as far as I know. But the reality is I did grow up in the Midwest. So Midwestern boy, Bible Belt. I grew up in the St. Louis region, spent most of my formative years.
I didn't know the St. Louis.
That's right. Growing up in like downtown area St. Louis, kind of on an odd border, actually, of like this really beautiful historic district. Like we were literally the house row that separated this really beautiful historic district called Lafayette Square, and then from the ghetto. And so like my backyard went to this historic district, my front door went into basically the ghetto. And so it was an odd mix where I couldn't really walk down the street at night and not be a little bit worried. And so I grew up learning to walk down the middle of the street if it was after dark. But at the same time during the day, I had this like beautiful cobblestone roads and like park and all these like 150 year old homes. And so it was an odd place to grow up, but I really cherish that mix and that Midwestern charm, that St. Louis and Midwestern charm that was there. And it was a slower, different way of life compared to after seeing both the coasts, you know, East and West Coast, and seeing that fast paced go, go, go drive. And it was like to recognize the slow down nature of that. It was a beautiful way to grow up.
So had you lived in places where you didn't necessarily have that resonance or didn't have that appreciation, or, you know, sometimes, like I lived in Miami for 5 years, and knowing what I didn't like was almost as valuable as being born into a Midwest, you know, salt of the earth, dependable, reliable, you know, sugar, bring sugar to the neighbor kind of thing. Have you lived in those places that you real that taught you something about yourself because of the negative energy, whether that's the hustle and bustle or the impersonalness? And where were those places?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, the times I lived in like Kansas City, especially the areas that were a little more, when we lived in Kansas City, we both lived in some rural areas, which were that same Midwestern feel, and some more of the deeper downtown.
Who's we both? You have a mask?
My wife and I, yeah.
Oh, your wife,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so when we were in Kansas City. And so, and the hustle and bustle of the city life. And so it's the traffic and the noise and the honking and the, hey, let's go, hurry up. And the, you know, right. Sometimes even the curtness of the more major cities, metropolitan areas, it's like, okay, I don't like this, which is odd, yeah. Actually. And I don't know if it's that mix, but growing up so close to downtown in St. Louis, when you're in downtown, it is that hustle and bustle.
Yes. Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah. I was surprised that you have such sort of that Midwestern, real, approachable, likable, charismatic vibe and energy that I think people know the Midwest stereotype, the positive stereotype. I was really surprised when you told me you were from St. Louis, and then sort of hearing what you're saying about the contrast. Do you think that contrast between whether that was the nice Lafayette cobblestone area or St. Louis, which is a very real city, or like you said, even the other side of the train tracks, kind of that perspective helped influence you or your understanding of the world growing up? Because those formative years before you leave the nest are really kind of what stick and shape with you a lot of ways throughout life.
Oh, no doubt. So it was, you know, because, you know, when you were in the historic district, it's like, I can remember on Sunday mornings walking to pick up the Sunday paper down from the park, you know, 10 or 12 blocks. And it was no problem to go pick up the Sunday paper for my dad or to walk to the park with friends to go to the hill that was in that historic district to go snow, you know, sledding or whatever in the winter. Versus like if I was on more of the city side, like literally my front yard was like, I can remember at 16, my car, I'd come out front to go in my car and my door lock would be hanging out because somebody all night was yanking on it, trying to get my door to open, right? So they could steal my car. And so having that contrast, I think of like, hey, let me walk this way. Let me walk a little farther south. And suddenly I'm in this beautiful historic area. I can go see my friends. I can go sledding, you know, without my parents' supervision and be fine. Or I can go out front and worry about, am I going to get jumped? And that was my, you know, later my dad would tell me like, yeah, we put you in so much martial arts and stuff because I didn't want you to be the kid getting jumped, because what was literally happening was gangs would cruise around and yeah. They would say, okay, you know, to initiate somebody, they say, you got to go beat this kid up if they saw somebody around. And so he always wanted to make sure I was prepared. And the reality is I was a little bigger anyways, right? Just blessed to have a little bit bigger stature and love to weightlift because my dad, but it was like, that was a real fear for them. And so it was that weird dichotomy of like, I can walk this direction and be fine. I can walk this direction and I need to work, make sure I carry my wallet in my front pocket. And so I think that contrast really did bless me on that front of, I knew how to handle myself, right? I knew how to walk around, which was actually an interesting story of, because my wife grew up in Oregon, Portland in Southern Oregon, and they have a lot of homeless people there, right?
Now, and, especially, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of the homeless people, though, are very nice. Okay, they're very sweet there. They're homeless by choice.
They're from Oregon. Of course they're nice.
Exactly. Yeah, they're just super chill. And but growing up around downtown St. Louis, a lot of the homeless people were not chill. Yeah. Right? They would take a dump right in front of you, or they, you know, if you offered them a sandwich instead of money, they were pissed. Excuse my language. They were upset. And so when we went to Oregon and we were in an area that had a lot of homeless people, I was on alert. Like, hey, kids, stay in this area. Back up a little bit, like, let me do the talking. And my wife was like, what are you doing? like, just chill. They're cool. Like, we'll just go sit and have lunch with them. Like, do they even want to have lunch with us? Like, because in St. Louis, if I said, like, somebody's like, hey, you got some money? Like, no, I got a sandwich. They didn't want your sandwich.
Right,
they
right.
Cash. And so it was that was a huge difference for me of like making sure I could balance that. But because I grew up understanding like, hey, in these areas, you need to be a little hypervigilant. But at the same time, you want to be kind and you want to be kind and have that charisma. And so that contrast was a really interesting way to grow up.
But it says a lot about you and your journey and your path and your upbringing, whether that's parenting or brothers and sisters, which I want to ask you about in a second, that, you know, you could go either way. And I don't think there's anything inherently positive or negative about being born in the worst city on planet Earth, or one of the most dangerous cities in the country, and being born in one of the most stunning, beautiful, you know, idealistic. Matter, there's pros and cons of both. And you're saying about the contrast is really fascinating, because I think what you're saying is it taught you how to not be polarized, how not to be extreme. You know, some people who grow up in a hard city, whether that's LA, Houston, New York, Miami, they're very streetwise. They're very conscientious. They have thicker skin. There's a lot of attributes that being raised that way gives you that wouldn't get growing up, you know, in a closed Amish community or rural Montana or something like that. And you could go either way. You know, you could join the tough hustle and bustle city, skeptical of people that when when they open the door for you, what are they going to do to me? Yeah. Or you can choose to sort of let your Midwest values come through. And, you know, that's something that can't be faked. And that's something that I admire that you emulate. What do you think your parents and siblings had to do with your upbringing, shaping the good stuff? You know what I mean? To make you the person that you are today.
Yeah, I mean, so I had an interesting blend of parents who, like, my dad was college educated and very much like into personal development. I mean, I can remember he had all the Tony Robbins cassettes.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was reading Stephen Covey from a young age, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so the personal development, the management style, the, you know, get educated, plan things out, have a goal, set a strategy from him was stellar on that front. And then my mom, she was not as educated, but her emotional intelligence was really high. And so she was a major extrovert, could always sell. The joke that was always, you know, kind of around my dad and I, but was a true joke, was she would run banks. She did banking and she would manage these banks, which education-wise she had no business doing, but she could do it. But she would work with all these people in St. Louis who were from a very diverse background, who spoke almost no English, whether they were Mexican or like Nicaraguan or African, like spoke no English. And she would have this way of communicating with them. And it would be like she was translating, but she didn't know the other language because she could connect with them emotionally. And so I had this really interesting blend of like extroversion and like emotional connection mixed with this drive and goal setting and strategy that I think has really served me in that way of being able to say, okay, here's what I want. How do I set up a goal for it? And then also, how do I work with the people? How do I be relational on that front? And I think those lessons have been incredible for me as far as, you know, growing a career, growing a passion, growing a family, even of creating a network. So even, you know, the way I put it now is like the path I've been put on my career, there's always points you can look back at and say, okay, that was a major turning point, right?
Yeah.
And so I had a good buddy of mine who him and I had really connected. And I would kind of put that as like, that was my mom's connection point, right? Her emotional connection, him and I connecting on some degree and me kind of like networking to some point, but also just forming a positive emotional connection. But he saw my ability to work hard and how driven I was and how invested I was in honing my craft of energy medicine and chiropractic and functional medicine. And so when it came time for me to be looking for work, I had my own little practice, but somebody came to him to run and work in a major line clinic into biologics. And he said, you know what? I got this buddy, Martin Hart. He's going to be fantastic. He's like, I'm not a good fit, but this guy's going to be your fit. And so it was like that combination of like my dad and my mom in me, that drive plus that emotional connection that allowed, like, that was a spark point for him, right? And so I can see in my life how much over and over again that's been a game changer for me, having that dual focus where I'm not just purely driven, but I'm also emotionally and connectionally focused.
Well, and if I can be a mirror to you and for you, just in the short time that I've known you, that's one of the things that strikes me right off the bat with you, is that balance between the emotional intelligence that you're raw modeled and imprinted on you, and your dad's drive and determinism. It's something that's very charismatic. It's very likable. Just like you were saying, your mom can communicate with people in other languages, which I think we understand as practitioners, but I don't know that we as people always understand that or remember that, or most importantly, practice that. And, from my very get-go of my interacting with you, I've really admired your approachability, because it's rare. It's I can tell you it's rare in this area, in this state, and I can absolutely assure you it's rare during the last couple of years and a lot of the challenges that we've faced. And that this will be the end of the program, so you can tell the secret at the very end. The secret is how you've kept that up, mm-hmm. and thrived in the face of it. Is so don't blow the punchline. That's going to go for that very end of the show. But let's go back to your siblings and what influence, like birth order, what influence did your siblings have on you? Did they teach you to fight or nurture you?
Yeah, so I have one younger sister. And she's 4 years younger than I am. And I say, a biggie for, if I'm hindsight's 2020 looking back, I'd say the biggie is like the balance between like love, nurturance, and leadership, right? Like being that compassionate older brother who can lead her. And also just having that little bit of sibling rivalry and being of a poke and prod and teaser, right? And so I can recognize the years where like, I didn't like the way of overly teasing her made me feel, you know what I mean? Like, of course we all try that out. Right. And so it's like, and I'm talking fairly young. And then it's like, as we got older and it was like I really cherished that older brother role.
Yes.
Right. Like even to the degree of like, even I think before my dad even had a chance, it was like, if she brought a boy around, especially in our circles, because of my reputation in our high school circles. But it was always like, if you're going to date Marty's sister, you need to go meet Marty first.
So that you enjoyed that protector role of your sister from a young age. That resonated with you.
For sure. Yeah. And because I did. And she ended up, even coming to the same college I did and getting to be with her during some of those years, her first year, my last year, and make sure she was taken care of and the school she was at. I was in a fraternity. And so I made sure, my fraternity brothers, if she needed anything, she was always taken care of. And so she was, always had that solid. And so I always wanted to make sure that was there for her. And so now as adults, her and I like, we have such a good bond of just friendship, other than just siblings. It's a very good friendship bond of being able to call each other for having a hard time and talk through it or help each other out when it's difficult. And so I got to be her, I got to officiate her wedding when she got married to a great guy. Love him. He's a fantastic brother-in-law and great husband for her.
Wait, so you're a preacher also and a healer, right? And a chiropractor and an
I give a fantastic sermon. If you haven't heard me give a sermon, I give a fantastic one.
I'm a turkey, based me.
Yeah, so
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, so it was a big blessing. I do love to actually give a nice little preachy message sometimes on my views on spirituality. I don't get too stuck in one tradition or not, but definitely, my family tradition and my personal tradition is definitely Christianity, but I don't get too orthodox. And so I love to give a good message on God's love and wisdom and just how, the subtext, the sub message of what I feel like, Jesus was trying to preach and how that really can affect every one of us, whether or not we want to be a born again, washed in the blood Christian, or whether we just want to hear his message. And so, I feel very blessed that my sister gave me the opportunity to officiate for her. And and to share that special role.
Well, so the Christian values, like you said, being, I guess St. Louis is the Bible Belt. I got to get that. But Missouri, absolutely. Your faith and your, you know, we tend to think of religion as being something that happens earlier in life because, mm-hmm. you know, you're organized and you're trying to learn how to put your spiritual steps together. And then it may evolve into a developed understanding of whatever ethos or dogma. You know, I grew up in a Methodist church, for instance. You would obviously those Christian values, and more importantly, your connection to a higher power had to obviously be a big influence as well as your parents or your sister or what your environment that you grew up in.
It was big.
That's not really a question. I'm just telling you that, right? Can I put a question mark on the end of that?
Just so you know, I think, you know, grammatically, I don't know if it's appropriate, but I see what you're trying to say. It's, you know, my dad and his family grew up Catholic. So I was baptized Catholic at a young age and went to Catholic school. And we occasionally went to Catholic church. And so and up through, you know, 12th grade, up through high school, I was in a Catholic school. So Catholicism, I know very well. And then my mom was Pentecostal. So if you don't know Pentecostal, it's very much that charismatic, deep spiritual movement of like speaking in tongues, people passing out in church, that whole, you know, the deeply kind of the really extreme version of that's like the holding the cobras and stuff. And so that was very interesting for me to have that dichotomy of some Sundays I was in a charismatic service and people were passing out in the pews and being washed in the spirit. Yeah. Other ones were talking tongues and the other
like
one
like in Blues Brothers.
Yeah, for real. Yeah. It was very much what was happening in that church service every Sunday. And then the flip side of the Catholic service, which is very routine, systematic, sometimes dry, but there's beauty later. I realized in that routine that you could really almost like a mantra meditation, you can lose yourself in that service. And there's a beauty to that. And so for me, it was kind of like,
you mean lose yourself in the moment, or lose yourself in the energy of the room? And
yeah, it was in a good way. Like you would kind of drop that egoic state and just get into the, you know, the up, the down, the up, the down, the prayer, the same prayer chant, the same hymns. And it was like you didn't have to think too much. You could just, you know, if you were just overburdened, you could just surrender to that routine.
Yeah.
And so there was a true, especially even in college when I kind of said, I don't know what I believe. I believe there's a higher power. I would still go to Catholic services sometimes. I would sneak in on Sunday because I could just sit in the back and let that wash over me. And so that balance
probably get that comfort, right? That similar comfort that you got in the Catholic as a child.
No doubt. And so it was huge. And so I did for a long time, you know, what I always joked about with Catholic school and Catholic teaching was like, they oddly teach you the things that helps you dismantle or deconstruct the particulars of the faith. And then they still expect you to hang around. And so for me, you know, I was kind of like, I can remember, and I think I was a sophomore in high school. And I kind of remember like, hey, if I got you right, what you're saying is Constantine basically developed most of the current traditions we have in the Catholic Church. And they're kind of like, wow, that's not. And I was like, wow, that's kind of what you said. That's what the book is saying. And
so you're a rebel. Now you're telling me you're a rebel.
That's right. Well, I questioned authority, no doubt. I don't love authority, which actually was an interesting faith journey for me, or a spiritual journey, because the idea of a God was at least a personal God was really difficult for me for a long time because of that rejection of authority. I don't want some guy telling me what to do. You know, I don't care if he's God.
I can see
you know
that.
What I mean? And so I don't want somebody. And so that was an interesting surrender experiment later in my life. But and just to walk that path eventually of trying to sort out, because I dove in that same drivenness that my dad gave me was, let me research all of this. And so I wanted to understand it. So for a while, I walked away from the church. I said, I believe in a higher power, no doubt. I didn't design all this, right? But I don't know what it is. I was like, somewhere between 10 and 12. And I was sitting in the Pentecostal service and I can remember standing up kind of like, hit me, God, like, give me, talk me in tongues.
Yeah.
Zap me out. What? Get me.
And trying to plug in.
Yeah. And I was like, all right, I don't know what everybody else, like, I can remember after that, like, nothing happened. And, like, I can remember afterwards thinking, like, okay, maybe I don't know what all these people are talking about. Maybe, like, and even to some degree, it was kind of like my mom could speak in tongues and her life was still a mess. And so I'm like, maybe this isn't the end all be all. And so it was like, you start to, you know, things unravel. And so later in life, my oldest son was maybe about 5 or 6 and asked to start going back to church. And so my wife and I, we took him to church and we'd go have coffee. And then during the service, while he went to youth group, and then we started to go listen. And I kind of said, okay, God, like, you know, I had a moment to moment. God, I said, hey, look, I've got to understand this. I've got to be able to wrap my rational brain around this just a smidge for me to be willing to step back in some. And so I read all different versions of the Bible, studied a little bit of the Aramaic, studied a little bit of the Greek, Koine Greek, tried to understand, and it led me to a very different place. And so I do love to debate Bible theory from that standpoint, because it's so different when you really understand from that context. And what led me to a place of, like, you know, I eventually got rebaptized in a non-denominational church, and I got baptized in the Mormon church. I'm totally covered, baptized 3 times.
You better know, safe than sorry.
Yeah, I'm good. And so it led me to a very unorthodox sort of place of, like, just this love for God, but also this kind of, like, I'm willing to doubt, like Thomas, St. Thomas, you know, I'm willing to doubt. And, like, and I think God and I have come to this place of, like, hey, yeah, I'm good with that relationship. Like, I'm getting better and better with the mystery, the more and more I surrender. But there's still that rational part of me that's kind of like, I'm going to hold some of these things in limbo and we'll just see where they take me.
You know, it's interesting. Religion and faith is something that, like many topics now, although I think it's gone down the list of things you shouldn't talk about, yeah. Whether that's politics or you know, pandemics or wars or whatever. Friends of the show know that the spiritual side of things is a very important ingredient in not only what we talk about here, but in health, in wellness, yeah, and in healing itself. You know, I'm trained, so if I have a new patient that comes in the door and they say, are you a Muslim, or are you a Christian, or do you believe in God, I'm trained to say things like, is that important to you, or why do you ask, or mm-hmm. You know, I was raised, it was rude to answer a question with a question, but that's literally how we're trained. So it's not something that we as practitioners usually reveal or feel comfortable about revealing. Yeah. But the other thing that strikes me about you is, unless you're like, I don't know, one of the world's best actors, it seems to me that you are in touch kind of with your genuine self, and you project and emulate your genuine self. You're not putting on an air, you know, to sell a business or a widget or whatever. I think your ability to help people and heal people and access people comes from their awareness, probably on a spiritual level, but certainly on an unconscious level,
yeah,
that you, and maybe this is my bias again, I don't know if it's against Mormons, it's for Mormons, my bias for Mormons, that tend to walk the walk, yeah, and people can see that into you. It's hard to take advice to heart, pun intended, about weight loss when your doctor's 500 pounds, right?
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is spiritual fitness and how spirituality plays a role in our mental health, our physical health, our existential health. But that's sort of mid-show stuff too. I want to circle back to catch me up to college. So you fly the nest. You tell me about your college and training. Nobody gives a crap about mine. It's on the website somewhere.
I appreciate that, Mark. And I do really appreciate your, you know, I wanted to touch on this earlier, but I got distracted talking about myself, which, you know, who doesn't enjoy
that's
that?
My favorite subject, talking about myself.
That's right. But I do appreciate how easy it was for you and I to connect so quickly, and I think so intensely. So I appreciate that about you so much.
You're like a younger, less hairy, less sunburned, better version of myself. But I'm sure there's a lot of things I can do better than you. I'm still trying to figure them out. But
I don't doubt they're in there. I might be a little more handsome. I don't know about better, but I'll take
well, handsome. I'll give you handsome.
Yeah, deal.
How tall are you? Because you and I, as much as we've talked about getting together, have physically not gotten together yet.
That's true.
Although I hope
it's like a Tinder profile. How tall are you?
Yes, this is a job interview and a Tinder profile.
That's right.
Is that the gay one or is that Grindr? Did we get that right? Tinder?
I started dating my wife well before.
Okay, good.
The things were a thing.
Don't make me feel old because I don't know what any of that stuff is.
I joke when I hear people talk about that. I'm like, I have no, the dating scene these days sounds terrible. But I always joke, I'm just a smidge under 6 foot, 5'11", 3/4". So,
all right.
On the old all football right. stats, big. I was definitely 6 foot.
That's big enough, so. I guess. I don't know if that's St. Louis large, but, you know, my brother was 6'5", and you did not cross him.
No. That's a beast of a man.
He could snap you like a twig. He was like a Viking, you know, just this, maybe not as good looking as Chris Hemsworth, but just a monster of a man. And like 16.
Oh my God.
You know, he was playing Little League. He's 6'4". And they're like, show me the birth certificate. There's no way.
Had to show up every game with one.
So you get to where did you go to college? What did you study? How did you get your training? And when was there that fork, like you were talking about in the road, that steered you in the direction that you're on now?
So I went to the University of Central Missouri, which is, you know, purely a little town called Warrensburg, purely Midwestern town. I mean, it's the epitome of a Midwestern town. You know, we had a huge agricultural program for all the farm boys coming in.
4-H clubs
for them. Oh yeah, it was huge there. And so
I don't know what that is, but my wife told me about it once.
Oh yeah, we used to do a lot of 4-H club because we ran a 20-acre farm for a while, my wife and I. So mostly her, but you know, going to college is interesting because I wanted to play arena football. My whole goal was to go pro and play arena football, and I was too undersized to go Division I. You know, I can remember getting recruited for football and like large schools telling me, if you're, my dad's like 6'2" plus and whatever, they said, if you're as big as your dad, you probably go D1. And I was so mad at my dad and mom, because my mom's like 5 foot tall. And so I knew my arena football days were done, because then arena football ended that same year. It was done. And so I didn't even know if I wanted to go to college. And so my dad, I was like coming to the end of my senior year of high school. And my dad said, hey, look, you got accepted all these schools, scholarships to all these schools, even just for academics. And he said, just pick one. He's like, just pick one. And what
so
we'll
you
do,
were a good student, obviously.
Yeah, I was on a roll. I didn't have to try that hard. And I was nearly a 4.0. You know, it was academics. For all my odd learning disabilities, I had a lot of like OCD, PANS, PANDAS symptoms as a kid and learning disabilities. And, you know, through some blessed mentors and teachers and a little bit of help along the way, I became a very good student. And, you know, God helped me use my brain in a way that worked for me. And so, you know, the academic side was not hard at that point. And so my dad said, look, here's what we're going to do. You're going to pick a school, pick anyone. And I'd worked for him. He's a construction manager. So I'd worked for him for some summers before. He said, you're going to come to work for me this summer. He said, if you don't want to go to school, you'll enroll and become a carpenter apprentice and you'll start in the superintendent track. He said, I won't hire you unless you're willing to go as a superintendent. He said, but if you don't want to do that, then you're already enrolled in school and you just show up to school. And so I did that summer, and I thought, you know, do I want to do this for 40 more years? Absolutely not. So August came around. I went to University of Central Missouri, started out studying biology, did some athletic training. And athletic trainers, you know, you watch Sunday sports, and those are the guys who run out there when the players are hurt in the field.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I really loved that. I did. I was very good at it. You know, you do rehab before school. You go to school in those afternoons. You would go to practices. What I didn't like was how long you spent around waiting for someone to get hurt. And I actually, because you would be bored. You'd be 4, 5, 6 hours at a practice doing nothing, filling up water bottles.
Sounds like anesthesia.
Yeah.
Hours of boredom surrounded by seconds of sheer terror.
Exactly, yes. And so I recognized it wasn't for me the moment I found myself hoping someone rolls an ankle.
Yeah, right.
You know, I thought, I don't like the way that feels.
Right.
And so
you're like in your early 20s at this point, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so I switched into exercise science. I knew I was going to go get a higher education, but I wanted to take a little bit of gap time. So I did a year as a corrective exercise specialist and personal trainer. And then I ended up enrolling. I applied for both PT school and chiropractic school because I'd been to chiropractors my whole life, an acupuncturist and homeopaths. And so I went to chiropractic school with the thought of being a sports guy, because in my later years, that's all I had been: rehab, orthopedic, chiropractors. And thank God I took that year off in between, because if I had to go to, 12 years of up to high school, then I graduated in 3.5 years from my undergrad, and then another 4 years of doctorate schooling and in clinicals, I think I would
You'd
have
look
quit.
like this, man.
That's right.
Your
You did it.
face
You
would
probably
look
did it
like it
straight
wore out
through.
two bodies.
And so I'm so glad I took that break. And so I jumped into chiropractic school and had an odd experience of basically wanting to do rehab and thinking all these alternative medicine guys and these overly now I was into supplements and stuff, right? Natural diet supplements.
Okay.
But the full paradigm, that true natural health kind of like mind, body, spirit paradigm, I wasn't there yet.
But how did you even get as far? Is it because of, like you said, your dad's modeling and just being, you were wrestling or some sort of a jockey type of thing,
Yeah.
and you were interested in your health and your body and what you put into it. Most kids aren't that doing that at that age.
No, I started. My dad got me into weightlifting when I was 10, and so I played all the sports. I was a pretty good athlete, but what I found could set me apart. And my dad was not particularly athletic, but he was very strong, and he competed in a couple of weightlifting competitions back in the day, and so. He at 10 years old had put me on an age appropriate program. And ever since then, I had started weightlifting. And that set me apart, especially in high school sports and things. I was very strong. And so when I got to college, I decided not to play college ball because I knew I wasn't going pro. And I did a lot of intramurals. But what I started doing was competing in weightlifting. I was a power lifter in college. I did
Okay,
very, very
so
well. Won a couple, like 2 years, I won the campus strongest man competitions. And
that sort of set the stage for diet and nutraceuticals and paying attention to your body. Were you making the connection to what you were putting in your body, whether that was diet, food, supplement, nutraceutical stuff, and working out, were you paying attention to how that was shaping your mind at that point, do you think?
Not yet totally. So I understood the idea of I understood the meathead philosophy of protein, right? But I was a super picky, still stemming from my OCD days. I was still super picky about textures and foods. And so the only veggies I really ate was carrot sticks. And so I really wasn't into veggies. And when I was 16, I got mono really bad. And that's when, I drink protein shakes with my dad, but then my dad kind of said, "Hey, like, because I was set this I like when I was 16, we were going into track season, and I was set to be the top shot putter on the team, and I got mono at the beginning of the season, and so my dad kind of knew that, like, hey, this could mess you up for where you're headed, and so he started me on this regimen of supplements, and it made a huge difference, and so that got I started reading all these, and I became a voracious reader, and so I started reading all these books my mom and dad had on nutrition and supplementation and all that sort of jazz at that point. Andrew Weil was a big
Oh
one I
yeah,
read.
the
And
late great.
oh yeah. Read a lot of his work in college and early and late high school. And so that started me on the front of at least supplementation. And that I think actually made a big shift. That made it probably a big shift for my brain. Just from that kind of that OCD state. Because then I started taking supplements that made me feel better. Right? I could tell a difference. And it's an odd story to go back and think about my OCD days, especially when I wasn't eating anything that was really that good for me, because I
Yeah.
wouldn't eat any very many veggies and just a little bit of fruit. And my mom had me convinced, even as a child, that she would make this greens powder in orange juice, and she had me convinced it was Ninja Turtle slime.
Whatever
And
works, man. I tell my kids Santa Claus is real.
that's right. I mean, philosophically, we could have a debate that he is real, but we don't have to get into that right now. But
He is
it's a
real. What are you talking about?
exactly. Yeah. If any of my kids listen to this. And so But I would even try to convince my friends to drink some. They're like, ah, no, that tastes terrible. But it kept me going. And so I could start to see this difference of like, especially that age of 16 when I got mono, like, hey, what I'm taking making a difference. And so it got me started that cycle, especially when I was starting to compete in weightlifting and sports. And so I knew I wanted to go down this track of rehab or being a strength coach. And I did spend some time as a strength coach for high school sports going down that realm of basically like health and performance route. I knew I was headed in that way.
So that that started quite early for you. That explains a lot for me too. And then, and then chiropractor school happens. Have you met Jen at this point or where does family life weave?
Yeah, I met Jen right after I graduated from school. So I graduated a little early, a semester early from my undergraduate. And I started initially working at this gym. This is a fun story to tell. And my wife, Jennifer, was in sales. And I was a personal trainer, corrective exercise specialist at this gym. And so the first couple of weeks I'm there, I've got a couple of clients. I haven't met all the staff yet. I hadn't met Jennifer yet. And so we had a supplement store there. And if you sold some supplements as a personal trainer, you got the commission, right? And so, but if there wasn't a personal trainer, whoever checked them out at the register got the commission. So the general manager takes my client up to the front desk, says, hey, check this guy out for Marty, my first name, right? Check this guy out for Marty and get him all set up. And so I go behind the front desk and she starts ringing this guy out and she puts her commission code in. And so, and then she checks him out and he goes on and she turns, and I didn't know what was happening. I couldn't tell. I didn't know the system yet. And she turns around and sees my name tag on my poppin' pecs, right? And she says, you're Marty. I said, yeah. She was like, I didn't mean to steal your commission. Oh my gosh. I thought that guy was Marty. I thought the old guy was Marty. I didn't realize you were Marty. I stole your commission. I'm so sorry. And I didn't know really what was happening, but being that charismatic Midwesterner, I said, you know, you can make it up to me with some dinner. And
nice, smooth.
That's right.
Smooth as a baby's behind.
Oh,
so
yeah.
She's like, how many babies did you get out of that deal, by the way?
We have four kids all together.
High five. I'm coming to the four club right behind you, brother.
I hear that. It's a good club to be in. You got to have a bigger vehicle and you're always a little outnumbered, but it's a good club to be in. So yeah, that sparked my journey. I went to chiropractic school, but I started off in the rehab sector, especially already being a corrective exercise specialist. So I thought the mind, body, spirit realm was a little woo woo. And I tried to transfer to PT school and, you know, God, the universe led me in this interesting direction of like, while I was trying to transfer, I met some people who did a little bit of some of the body testing kinesiology we do now.
So let me back you up a little bit. When you were talking about chiropractors that influenced you to go into school for chiropractics, who were they?
Yeah, the main ones, you know, what's interesting to think about that is I can remember as a younger kiddo, totally having some of the more like natural medicine based, what I would call like alternative medicine based chiropractors who were doing some herbalism and some homeopathy with their chiropractics. But when I was a teenager and older, all the chiropractors I went to were all what I call orthopedic based,
right?
All sports medicine.
And the so I can remember,
And so I was getting adjusted for various sports injuries and things like that. And, you know, some of them I can't even remember because I would go to the local chiropractic college. My mom would take me to the local chiropractic college. And so I probably had two or three interns who were, you know, finishing up their clinicals there. And God bless them, you know, blessings onto them for working on me. I can't remember their name. I'm sorry, but they did great work and definitely influenced me. And so I wanted to be in orthopedics and sports medicine, rehab stuff was kind of my mindset.
I missed that little gap there between, you know, you being interested in personal health and training and growth and paying attention to your own body, to how that took a little bit of a fork into the chiropractic background training.
Yeah.
How much chiropractics do you do? What percentage of your current practice is chiropractics?
I do a little what I would call structural work on everyone, but pure kind of like what we would call like musculoskeletal work. I mean, probably less than like 35%. I mean, and the reality is even that 35% is they're probably here for some other functional, like functional chronic complaint.
Okay.
I'm primarily at this point doing functional medicine, Lyme, mold, autoimmune stuff, gut stuff, kind of operating in that realm. So, and that was basically from the get-go with that journey. So I tried, you know, halfway through chiropractic school, I was like, these guys are wacko. I'm going to go.
The energy guys are wacko.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. And you're like 24 years old at this point?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yep. Probably 24. Yeah. 24, 25. And so I'm like, these guys are nuts. I'm going to transfer to PT school. And so my wife, God bless her, was like, I found a PT school in Florida that I could transfer to from Kansas City. And she said, hey, look, we'll do it. Well, the whole family will move if we have to. I had a few kids at this point. And she said, but let's just finish out this semester at school and wait till you're officially accepted. And so I was bickering back and forth with the school about accepting different credits because I don't have to redo or spend any more money if I don't have to. And in that time, I started shadowing some chiropractors who did, they were sports chiros for the local pro soccer team. And they did some interesting versions of muscle testing and then rehab. So they'd muscle test a muscle and then rehab it. And I thought that was cool. And so I started using that with my intern patients. And it wasn't that effective. Like the muscle.
But it wasn't kinesiology as people think of it. Okay.
No.
But it was a type of muscle testing. Gotcha.
Yeah, it was a bridge between like physical therapy, orthopedic muscle testing, and a little bit of like kinesiology muscle testing. And so, but they didn't do anything special. They just did rehab with those muscles. And so I thought, okay, where did they learn this? And they learned that from a physical therapist who worked with the Utah Jazz and worked with a chiropractor who did an early version of the technique I do now called clinical kinesiology. And so I thought, okay, that's pretty interesting. And so I went and learned a little bit of that technique, and it was a little more effective, but still was not that great. And so then I went a step further and said, okay, where did these guys develop this from? And that was, they developed it from applied kinesiology, which is like, they're looking at how the neuromuscular system is affected by infections, emotional stresses, chemical stresses, et cetera. And so I said, okay, let me look at this training. Well, that training was going to cost me a few thousand dollars, okay, outside of my schooling. And I had kids. I was working a part-time job in addition to working on my doctorate. And I said, oh, this is a really big investment. And at this point, I already knew I'm in school. I'm staying, right, to some degree. I'm like, I think I'm on this track. And but the semester wasn't quite over. And somebody says, hey, look, there's this guy coming to town. He's got a weekend seminar. It'll cost you the same cost as going out to dinner with your wife. He's trained with all the people you're talking about. You know, all the people you've been talking about lately, he's trained with all of them, including the founders of those techniques. Well, why don't you go and see? And this guy's technique, somebody had already tried to talk to me about it. And I said, this sounds too crazy. Don't even talk to me about it.
Is this the guy that I think that it is? The guy we talked about? Okay.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so I went and I said, okay, I'm all in. I'm going to, you know, just kind of that same drivenness. I'm going to give it 30 days.
Leap of faith, really.
Yeah. So I did it. I went to the seminar. I started training in it. About halfway through that 30 days, Jen throws her back out, right? My wife throws her back out, which happens once a month. I would adjust her. She'd be fine. That wasn't happening this time. And so at this point, in order for us to save money and her to, because we had four kids now, she was running an in-home daycare so she could stay home with our kiddos and make some money. And I had to cancel my classes that day and stay home with the kids because her back was so bad. I was carrying her to the restroom so she didn't wet herself, right? And so, and screaming the whole time I would carry her. It was quite the sight. I'm taking care of these babies. I'm trying to take care of her. She refused to go to the ER. She's like, we can't afford the ER.
Women, they're just so thick-headed, aren't they?
Something like that. I won't agree too much because she'll probably listen to this later. But
they know we're the ones with the thick heads.
They do. Yeah. They even make us extra helmets for it. But, and so, I call my mentor, the guy I went to the seminar with, and I said, hey, look, I've adjusted her a couple of times. It's not working. Even in the living room, all these kids around, I just had laid out the chiropractic table. I said, what do I do? He was like, it sounds like she has this little thing where her dura mater, the connective tissue of her spinal cord, is torqued. And he said, all you do is you test these two reflex points, treat them, and usually it'll clear up. So I tested her for it. She had it. I treated those points, and within 30 minutes she could walk, and within the hour I could go finish the rest of my classes. And so she was like, as she got up and walked around, she said, this is what you're doing. We're going to throw the whole PT idea out of your head. This is what you're doing. And I was hooked after that. And so
I should have booked your wife for the show. It sounds like,
oh yeah,
she owes her your wife.
That's right. It was really her. She really threw me in it. I wouldn't be here without her. So
thank her for us.
I will. Oh yeah. She knows. She'll let you know for sure. I threw in, you know, full bore with him. So, and he said, you know, when you started training with him, he said, I would want you to go study this. So I studied acupuncture, go study herbalism. I studied herbalism. I bugged everybody until they drove me nuts. I studied in the school medical library until the librarian seen me by first name and didn't even check my library card every day. And so here I am, instead of rehab, I'm doing functional medicine, herbalism, Chinese medicine, and it was quite the trip.
Now, you worked at a different place before founding Keystone Total Health in Columbia, Tennessee. Tell me about that place, how you got in with them, how you grew there, what skills or insights did you gain, both personally and professionally?
Yeah, so Biologic Center is the center you're talking about, is a major Lyme center. They're originally in Kansas. They're now in Tennessee. And the way I got there is, in undergrad, I went to school with a guy who was also a shot putter, and him and I were in the same program. So we had kind of had a cursory knowledge of each other, would hang out and talk occasionally, but we're more acquaintances than friends at that point. And then I get to chiropractic school and this guy's there. Okay. And then not only is he there, he's studying with that same mentor that helped me correct Jin's back. And so it's like the universe keeps bumping us.
So it was a synchronicity moment for you.
Oh yeah. And so him and I become friends, especially as we train through this and bouncing ideas off each other, and we stay in contact. And so I graduate, we move to Oregon. I work in a practice where I'm doing a mix of my kinesiology and functional medicine and some pain work, right? I'm treating some pain cases and accident cases and a mix of functional medicine. And my gig there, the way I kind of made my niche in that area, was I would go to local doctors and other practitioners. And I would say, send me your hardest case that you can't fix and let me see what I can do. And
wow,
so
that's noble.
Yeah. It's maybe a little cocky, but it worked out for
cocky,
me.
Cocky is okay too. God, we need cocky right now.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Especially young. And so the founder of Biologic Center, Dr. Jernigan, had called up my buddy, who I had met through undergrad and chiropractic school, and said, hey, you know, I'm looking for to add more doctors. And he's a very good doctor. He said, do you either want to come on board or do you know somebody who wants to come on board for our clinic, our Lyme clinic? And he said, you know, I'm good, but I've got this buddy, Martin Hart, who I think is right up your alley. And so this guy calls me up while I'm in Oregon, and he says, hey, do you want to come look at my Lyme clinic in the middle of Kansas? And I was like, no. You want me to move back to Dusty, Kansas? No way. I just got out of there. There's no way I want to live. We lived on the Rogue River in Oregon. You know, we were literally a quarter mile walk from our back door to the Rogue River. It was beautiful, mountains, trees, the whole bit.
I'm guessing that helped shape you too, but
That was a fantastic time. And the laid back atmosphere of Southern Oregon is even more than the Midwest. You would go to a store and they would say, we're open from 9 to close. And close was never there done. So you had to call ahead, but you learned to respect it a little bit because they also gave you that same kind of relaxed courtesy, right? So it was a beautiful town. So eventually my wife's like, you're being really rude to this guy. Why don't you fly out and see what he's got? And so actually on our wedding anniversary, we fly out and I meet with him. And I so much didn't want to move back to Kansas that I didn't even bring a pair of nice slacks to the interview. So the interview is a Friday morning. I bring jeans. My wife says,
I wouldn't have pegged you for passive aggressive, Marty, but you're.
It's in there. I mean, it's a little aggressive, aggressive at times.
This is what happens when I hold you up on a pedestal too high to be reached. So
I'll knock it down and build it back up for you.
You passively aggressively go on.
Yeah. So I my wife's like, don't you dare walk to that job interview with jeans. Go to the store this morning and buy a pair of slacks. So I buy a pair of slacks. I walk in the front door and the clinic director goes, I should have told you Friday is Jean Day. So
Yes, you should have.
I'm like, all right, God, I see what you're doing here. And but I meet Dr. Jerry, I'm walking around this clinic, and the clinic is literally the picture of the vision board that we had at home. We used vision boards. I had this vision board of I was going to work in a holistic clinic that was based on herbalism that people would travel to. I had drawn a guy with a suitcase walking into the clinic because he had traveled to get there. And so at this clinic, most of our 80%+ of our patients were from out of state, out of country. They all flew in to see us. And we practiced holistic medicine, herbalism, the whole thing. And so after some deliberation, my wife and I decided we moved to Kansas. And so become a Lyme specialist, doing kinesiology and bioresonance work and frequency medicine and Swiss and American biological medicine.
And about how many providers at that time were with Biologics?
Yeah, there was including the founder, there was five of us all together with a staff of about 20 staff members, five doctors. And so eventually I became a senior doctor. I was a senior doctor there for 4 years with a clinic, a total of seven, where I was running a team of doctors. It was I'm so thankful for Dr. Jernigan, thankful for my buddy for putting me up, because Dr. Jernigan taught me so much. He and I actually shared that mentor. His name is Dr. Milton Dowdy, still in practice now in his late 70s. Great guy, fantastic guy, but Dr. Jernigan shared him as a mentor. And so, you know, Dr. Jernigan really took me under his wing and helped me grow. And working in that clinic was a fantastic opportunity to, you know, I joke that working in that clinic, because what we saw were the most complex cases. We saw the cases that other people couldn't correct, you know.
And I know, I sent them to you.
That's right. And I loved working with them. You know, it's a little sadistic, but it's well, I love, yeah.
Maybe it's sadistic, but I would say, and we use the word sadistic and cocky, but to me, what that tells me about you is that you wanted to believe in what you were doing, mm-hmm. and you wanted to know that what you were doing was really working.
Oh, yeah.
And a best way to prove that is to specialize in treatment refractory people, because yeah. they're the most enigmatic. They've eluded all these often 10, 20, 30 other providers beforehand.
No doubt.
And so that tells me a little bit about your drive and your curiosity and why you is the way that you is, which is the title of this show, by the way, if I have anything to say about it, why he is the way he is.
I love that.
It's either yeah. that or welcome Dr. Hart, something.
I like the first one a little better.
Yeah.
I mean, the second one's good and all, but I like a little fun in it. It's, you know, it really was. And I can recognize for me is like, I don't, and I still talk about this now. I hate the idea that somebody ends up being a medical refugee.
Yeah.
They go from camp to camp and they're stuck in no man's land.
Yeah.
And I hate it. And I, early on in my career, I could recognize that God kind of gave me this mission. And it was some version of like, hey, everybody's on this journey and your mission is to basically give them the next step they need to that journey. You don't necessarily know what that's going to be from case to case, but they're in this path of basically waking up, and your job, whether that's to help them on the healing journey or to give them a piece of information or send them in a different direction or give them a referral, is to guide them along. And I couldn't just do the basic pain cases because that wasn't my personality type. I was too driven. And so, and I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand more. I wanted to understand the way the universe works, the way the body worked. And if there was a glitch in the system, which is not a glitch, right? We know that. But if there was a seeming glitch in the system, I wanted to understand it for these people.
So that's really something
powered me through.
You and I think resonate on completely, and that I see so much of me and you and me in that piece, because enough about you. How about me? No. My background being in engineering was very analytical and always why. And when I got into medicine, I realized nobody ever asks why.
Yeah.
It was very peculiar to me. And if I asked why, to try to show them how smart I am or how, you know, really I'm asking why, because I can't learn things unless I understand them. I can't memorize something if I don't, you know, believe in it, if I can't see the whole, you know, holistic,
yes,
you know, and so you, it's interesting that you're very much wired that same way. And when you understand the why, then your ability to help people opens, I think, you know, I don't know if it's infinitely, but it opens tremendously to, in my best estimations, I was helping 20 to 30% of people with my very expensive allopathic training.
Yeah.
And now I like to say that that same level of help is probably in the 70, 80%, but I'm going to give something, some healing, some relief, some comfort, some reassurance, so whole emotional space. I can do that for 100% of people.
No doubt.
Come through my door.
I love that. Yeah. I think that analogy you're saying there is so pivotal. And so it's like, you know, are people from a medical standpoint is 100% going to get well? Not necessarily, but I think they're going to get some nugget from that presence that you bring, that compassion that you're going to hold for them is going to be beneficial, whether it's on a physical level or just an emotional, spiritual level. It's going to be, they're going to walk away with something that they didn't have beforehand.
And you try to do that with every patient, every time, every visit, really.
You have to. I think if you're going to be in integrity, you know, maybe I shouldn't say that. How should I say that? I say, if you're walking the walk that I think you and I are walking, and you're going to stay on that path and stay in integrity on that path, I think you have to at least have the intention to show up, yes, to every visit, every patient that way.
And so what, I guess the next question I have is, what are you doing now? Now that you've left the bio, you graduated from biologics, you're founding and developing, and you know, watching that unfold has been exciting, and I've been rooting for you and sending you good vibes. But what do you like specializing in? What do you see day in, day out at Keystone Total Health?
Yeah, so I definitely still love the mold and Lyme world, right? I definitely hit that mold and Lymeys really hard because they are the medical refugees a lot of times of the medical system. So I have a big heart for those folks. Mm-hmm. And then what a little bit of what the, you know, the God in the universe is bringing me right now is these pediatric cases and these family cases that are, you know, kind of out of the realm of what would be the typical pediatric realm, like, you know, if you don't have something that's too severe, like we don't know what to do. And so these cases of like PANS, PANDAS, maybe like mild learning disabilities, autism spectrum, odd stuff like that. I'm getting an interesting mix of that. And so it's like, I'm still loving the Lyme and mold world. And especially a big focus we're doing right now is mold. And so we're hitting that a lot because it's so translucent. We kind of talked about this before, but it's so mysterious for a lot of people. They don't know what's happening. A case I just had this week, who beforehand we had found she had mold and Lyme, and the family had thought they cleaned the mold out of the house, but she kept testing for it. Her body kept showing mold. And so, but they were sure they were cleared out of it. And so for 2 years, we had gotten her to this point, I couldn't get her any higher. But she kept showing up for mold. And so they couldn't find any more, right? But I knew it was still there. Well, so just this past week, they remodeled their bedroom underneath the carpet and walls, full of mold, layered through it. And it was like a boom. And so it's, people just don't know what's hitting them. And so it's throwing a curveball for both them as the people suffering and their practitioners. And so that mold world is something I'm really passionate about, especially even it was something I dealt with living in a basement throughout my teen years that leaked all the time. My parents, God bless them, thought they were doing something cool for me by letting me have my own room because we lived in a 2-bedroom house. And so they thought we were giving my own room in the basement. But unfortunately, it was a toxic cellar of mold.
So do you think living in a mold-filled toxic cellar really helped your development into the nice guy that you are today?
Maybe it's done in my growth. Maybe I can blame that for not being as tall as my dad.
That's my dry humor. We have a button that we just hit like for audience laughter when I make dad jokes.
That's right. Everybody loves a good dad joke.
Let's talk about you being a dad, because I know that's something that is a calling for you as well, and that you're very proud of. And you have 4 lovely children. The youngest is how old?
11. He's 11.
Oh, okay. My oldest is 12. So, yeah. Wow.
I started really young.
Yeah, so that's a interesting spread. How do you think either, well, we know your wife is calling the shots and telling you what to do at the critical moments. Have her give me a call so she can tell me too.
That's right.
My wife usually does the same thing, like, hey, I don't know if you noticed, but you've been beating your head up against that wall with the blood stain on it that matches your forehead. That's right. But, you know, having kids is a sacred blessing, really, for lack of a better word, because they do change you and they it, you know, sort of like the pandemic changed people in, into thinking about the Great Reset or the Great Resignation or all of the new cliches that kind of came out of there that represent real concepts. How did your kids evolve your personal and professional being to be a healer? Because I keep coming back to that word healer, Dr. Hart, because you are.
Thank you. Yeah, I you know, I feel very blessed to hear you say that, by the way. Thank you. And humbled to hear you say that. So it, you know, the kids, I think number one is like they jar you out of this narrow focus, right? And so I can recognize, you know, jumping into fatherhood at 22 is when I started. And it was like coming out of college and it was like I was very cocky and driven and very self-assured that I knew what I was doing, but to some degree very self-centered at that phase. Like I cared about people and I could connect, but it wasn't the same. And so starting to have kids, like it jars you out of that. Like, whoa, hey, like you're responsible for another life. And like, especially when you got a baby, you're like, hey, you know, at any moment this kiddo could die. You could roll over on this baby and kill this thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, okay. And so it jars you loose, and it not only jars you loose, but it's like it expands your mind of a you know, how far does my legacy go? How do I need to show up in a way that I want this child to show up? How do I connect
to be a role model and a mentor and a protector? And then how, so that brought that to you personally. How did that translate to the office and to how you treat patients and earn patients' trust and really gratitude for helping them?
Well, I think so quickly with the kiddo, you can see when you're in disconnection, right? You can see when you've made an oops and you've hurt them, or when you come for disconnect. And so it's like balancing that, you know, as a parent, you're learning to balance that connection with the wisdom you need. You need to balance the love and wisdom, right? Boundaries with unconditional love. And so you're learning to balance that. And so it's that same flow of patience of like, hey, I see you. And you're not, you know, kiddos, they're not necessarily in a state of like dysfunction, but they're in a state of immaturity that needs to be brought up. And patients are kind of that same way, but it's a state of dysfunction. Something's shifted for them that we need to bring into harmony. And so it's like you want to connect with them and create that both that love and wisdom for them that same way. So you want to build that same loving connection and then mentor them up and out of it, right? And so for me, just like with my kiddo, although on my kiddo world, I'm taking even stronger of a mentorship, but it's like, I want to be your Gandalf. I want to be the Gandalf to your Frodo. It's that same way with the kiddo, with a patient. It's like, I don't want to do this for you. I don't want to give you a medicine. I don't want to do a surgery. I don't want to give you a supplement that's going to do this to you. I want to do this with you. I want to bring you along on this journey out of this. And so it was that same front of like, hey, every impact I make on you, number one, is a part of my legacy, but number two is a part of my duty that I'm showing up, and I want to see you through that journey. Just like I want to see my kiddo through that journey, I want to see you through that same journey. And so I do think it helped me build a rapport that's very different maybe from the average. And I think you probably know this so well too. Like when I hear you talk about your patients, is like, it's a different rapport than the average person builds with their doctor.
Yeah. Like, so that's my next question. And are you sitting down for this one? Cause this is a tough one.
Totally.
Why has healthcare lost that, or did it ever have that?
You know, I think there were parts of healthcare way back in the day that used to have it. A lot of folklore, a lot of folk medicine definitely had it. You know,
shamanism. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, shamanism, the medicine man or medicine woman. You know,
the nettles.
Oh my gosh, yes. And I think there's a slightly different topic, but I'm a big fan of promoting what I call the corner herbal mother, the female medicine woman of the block, of the neighborhood. And so I do try to cultivate a lot of that in my female mother patients. But and so I think they, of course, had it because they were a part of the tribe, right? And then there was times when the family doctor had it, the local, especially the rural family doctor had it. He knew Billy, Sally, and Sue of the family. He knew everybody's history. He gave birth to them. He maybe gave birth to
Yeah.
their kids later, or not
There
gave
was
birth to
more
them,
of
but
that
delivered.
personal investment kind of thing or connection.
Yes, yeah, and I think, but at some point, and it's a mixing of time frames, but I think the initial was really when at some point we started around that industrial age, and there's a twofold thing that happened. Number one, medicine wanted to take primary space over the folk medicine and over the alternative medicine and the local people. They wanted to take primary over that. And so that creates this hierarchy, which don't get me wrong, there's inherent hierarchies in the world, but it created this false authority, which again, I'm inherently, I don't like. I don't reject authority, but over the people where they knew better than you. Okay. And so that there became that air. And at that same time, medicine went from a calling and a vocation to an industry. And once it
A
became an
business, yeah,
industry,
business industry, sure.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And once it became an industry, it became about money. And the worse we've gotten along that path where we go from big pharma and big insurance and then big hospitals, when we started down that path, it became too much. And you probably know this so much more acutely than I do, because early on I rejected the insurance model. After my very first year in practice, I realized this is going to kill me. I can't do this model. But is like that model drives so little true care. It basically turns doctors into robots. You have this, you take this, get out. If you don't meet this algorithm, sorry, you're stuck. And you just get churned through the machine. You get chewed up and spit out because they don't have time to make their quotas, to make their ends meet, right? As an individual doctor, they need to see so many patients every 5 minutes. And so it turns into this dual focus of like this hierarchy that's created. And then also the industry, the money funnel that gets created. And I think it really diminishes patient care.
Yeah, and it whittles away not only at patient care and exposes you to more medical errors and misdiagnosis, which
Yeah.
everybody, I hear this from patients across the board, but it really, the worst thing it whittled away at is that sacred connection between you and
Yes.
someone who wanted to help you and that trust.
Yeah.
And I can feel the sadness of that, which
Yeah.
is kind of odd. It's hard to explain to people, but I can feel that sadness of that loss of something that I, in my career, never really truly knew.
Yeah.
But I feel the sadness and the loss just by observing, like you said, how intolerant you were of the status quo and this model and the way people receive care. I think it's something I want no part to do with.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating and interesting to you is you've manifested that in your own career, and you've built this practice to help people and connect with people, and you're an expert in. You're just saying, oh, mold, I do some mold and I do some lime and I do some ASD. Marty, I'm a smart guy. I got lots of education, and there are things that you say that I'm like, how in the hell does this guy know this? Like, okay, so you have learned a your knowledge base, I can attest to. It's like any mechanic knows a good mechanic. Any doctor knows a good doctor. I want to be a healer when I grow up. And when I look at you, I can see what a great healer you are. And I've tested you, honestly. It's not part of my training is to toy with people's minds, but I've tested you. I don't know, maybe it was the other day on the thyroid stuff, like you know so much medicine and functional medicine. And that's why I asked how much chiropractic do you do? Because I'm thinking, yeah, you come from a background of chiropractics. Well, I come from a background of psychiatry. I don't really think of what I do as psychiatry. We do integrated health and functional medicine. Yeah, maybe there's a certain amount of basic bread and butter chiropractic care that absolutely that's what you're trained in. And you believe in that as well, but you realize that's one tool in a much bigger toolbox. And it's something else that I admire is not just your humility, but your knowledge base on some very, 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 very difficult topics. And then complex cases, things that have really 3, 4, 5, 6 layers to them. That's a whole different skill set, knowing which thread to pull on. You know, you and I have talked about that before and struggled with that before. And, you know, hey, maybe on this person with metal detox, they're going to heal faster through supporting their metal detox pathways or assisting metal out. Whereas this person with the exact same thing may release these toxins through energy work and through manipulation, biologic manipulation. And that to me is what I meant by, I don't understand. And I'm going to tell your age here. You're 37, right? I don't understand how a guy 37 years young has got that. It's really kind of a testament to how much you've studied and how much you've learned from your patients.
I do. You know, it's interesting of like, you know, I've had this discussion before. Like if people didn't have their wounds from like childhood, would they be successful? And I can recognize some of my, like the positive things of like the drivenness and stuff was like so beneficial for me, but also a little bit of that obsessive compulsive perfectionism I had from my childhood helped. And it is also this idea of when I train interns, you know, and you're like, hey, you've got this case coming in. And do you really want to walk in there Monday morning on this new case and you haven't reviewed their case or you don't know anything about the weird symptom they have? And so it was like, especially very early in my career, it was like before that case ever walked in, I wanted to know that their paperwork and their history and their medical history up, down, and sideways. If they had some odd diagnosis, I'm pulling out textbooks. I want to know everything about that diagnosis, right? And so what that starts doing is it's creating banks in the brain of like memory banks that you can store those things in. And so I wanted to really understand that. So when I train new doctors, that's one of the things I train them on is like, it's not even necessary that I want to teach you about thyroid and then teach you about this. That's good. And we'll cover that. But more so, I want you to know everything about this person. And if you can know everything about this person, you'll understand thyroid, no problem. Right. Yeah. And so, and when you can grasp that and then mix that in with a little bit of like toxic shame driving you, like, oh, there's nothing going to stop you. And so I joke now that if I were to start where I'm at now, would I still be as good? And maybe, but that first year or two of like a little bit of childhood wounds driving me, I think did make me a better doctor. And now having worked through a lot of that toxic shame, I can ride on a lot of that early work. But it's so much of it in my mind though is really, do you want to walk into that room with that person and look them in the eye and be underprepared? And to tell them that, you know, I don't know enough to help you. No, I don't anyways. I don't want to walk into that room. And I really like the idea of the engineering. You had an engineering background, because to me, when I try to explain something, I'm like, oh, I think in systems. I'm a systems thinker, which I think is how engineers tend to think.
Yep.
And are trained. And so it's like, and I, all you're doing is adding new things in those systems in your brain. So when a case comes in, it's like, I want to walk in and not just know things because I studied them well, but I want to know things because I know them. Yeah. I know them ahead of time, and I'm going to sit and get to know them. Because they're going to tell you things that are going to change the way you treat that case.
Constantly.
Yeah. And so the reality is it really comes down to connection, care, compassion, and connection. And when you have those things, you can figure out the rest.
All right. Now we're getting to the end and you can blow the punchline, but, and I'm asking for a friend.
Sure.
How have you kept your indomitable spirit and your attitude towards approaching some of the sickest people of our era and certainly of our careers? How have you stayed so resilient and maintained this indomitable spirit and show up passionate about what you do and wanting more of it. You're drinking from that fountain of youth. What's the secret? What does it all mean, Basil?
That's right. I think it's an interesting mix of, like, number one, I truly do believe it's my calling, right? Times as I've tried to work through it, or like, even I took a 3-month sabbatical and we lived on a Thailand island in Madagascar, and it was amazing, incredible. I could have lived there for $5,000 a year. And it was like, my wife's like, let's stay. And I couldn't stay. Right. And because I recognize that, like, I feel this sense of duty inside that if I'm not doing this for these people, then who are, right? That if I'm not here walking this path with them, then who is? And it's like this drive that's in there of like, if it's a little bit of maybe leftover perfectionism, but it seems to morph as I've done enough inner work. And it's not just like, hey, I don't want to be perfect anymore, and I'm afraid to not be perfect or good enough. It's like, at this point, it's like, hey, I recognize that I am good enough at this, and it's what I need to be doing. It's what I've been called to do. And then you throw in this idea of like, I do love it. I do have that drive to go for it. But it's also, I think there's some of these seeds that are already planted in our heart. And it's like, I want to be the best. Okay. And I've tried to even work that out and take my ego out of it. And it's like, put in this mantra of like, as well, of like, I want to be the best I can be. And inside my system is still like, oh, screw that. I don't want to be the best I can be. I want to be the best. And so it's like, I have this sense of like a providential duty, like somebody imbued this duty onto me, this responsibility that you know, it's like, if you walk by some trash on the street, it's like, I struggle to leave it too much. Right. Cause I'm like, I saw it. I knew it needed to get picked up and I didn't. And so I'm gonna let that down. And so like, magnify that by a bunch of like, I see these people waiting by the wayside. I know what I can do. How could I not do something about it to the best of my ability? Mix it with this drive of like, I want to be the best. And I can't, I've tried to work around it as egoic, whatever. It just lives in me that I want to be the best doctor I can. I want to be the best doctor out there. And I don't care about being famous. I don't care about making a bestseller book or any of that. I want that when you walk in the room and you're sitting in front of me and you've been everywhere, that I can give you the best care you're ever going to get because it's what you need right now. And so it's that weird drive that lives in me mixed with this sense of purpose and duty to keep pushing. And even when I've tried or I'm nearly burnt out, and I would say I probably already, because of that drive, maybe burnt out a couple of times in my career. The second I take a break, it's like, let's go. Okay, yeah. We're back in it. You know, here we go. Do it again. Or the second I go to train another doctor, I'm like, oh yeah, we're in this, baby. We're going for it. Give me another case. Give me that next one.
So, and it's a sacred, the only thing I would add to it, since you totally stole the words out of my mouth there, is that sacred space that I think, you know, you're calling it the calling or your purpose. If you're truly living in that, you really don't work a day in your life, but that when you share that sacred space of healing with someone else, whether, and of course they've suffered, of course they're sick. Yeah. Of course they felt gypped by the medical system or abandoned by this or that. That's, you can't put a price tag on that. You can't put really a label on that. Well, the French would, je ne sais quoi, but what do they know? No, there, that to me is the affirmation of your calling. That to me reminds me of why I do what I do. And that to me gives me a directional focus that maybe 10 other things didn't go right that day. That I'm on the right path and that I'm following, I'm in the flow, like we spoke before the show, and going with my greatest truth. So I'm just so grateful to have met you, and I'm certainly honored and privileged to collaborate with you on Patience and to call you a friend. And to me, I hope you realize I cannot think of anybody else truly on planet Earth right now that I would have considered continuing this legacy with besides you, which may sound like a strange thing because we don't know each other that well, but that's how much you emulate that to your patients, to me. And I think if I can ever figure out Instagram, to Instagram, you look really happy on Instagram. Does everybody look that happy on Instagram?
I think they do. You know, I think the editing's great on Instagram, but I am truly like it touches me deep to hear you say that. And it's maybe not odd, but it's unique to me how well you and I have connected so quickly and formed a quick friendship that I do. I mean, we've been, you know, chatting and working together for a few years now, but it's the reality is of how much we've been able to connect on that front is massive and definitely logarithmic versus the typical. And so I truly honor that and cherish it.
Yeah. Likewise, it's been synchronous, and, you know, it could be that, you know, we're both heterosexual, middle-aged, white, bearded, dashingly good-looking white bearded guys with wives and 4.0 kids. I mean, that's a tiny piece of it. We're at a similar lot in life, but I think that we're definitely on the same plane in terms of our passions and our future and the way that we want to see our legacy, what you were talking about, and the joy that we get from helping others. And I hope in the whole purpose of this podcast truly is to empower people to wake up to that, wake up that, you know, they are their primary caretakers, and to not get disillusioned when they go see a bad doctor at a bad hospital and a bad healthcare system, that there is hope, that there is an answer. And the vast majority of the time, they have seen so many people, they're so tired and worn out and really hopeless that they don't bring their best to you. And I want people to develop that level of trust in the ethos, which I think is going to be the model for this century. I truly do. And people, even down here, we're seeing wake up to that. And it's been a very exciting time during a very challenging space, a very challenging backdrop. It's very unique.
I think, unfortunately, you know, the idea of some of those areas like that of going through periods of time, which are hard and dark, they do truly, you know, if you look at history, create most of the blooms of light. And so I think so many people are kind of waking up on that front and finding that power within them to start to express, which I feel like it's like finding their true selves inside. And sometimes it takes that nastiness, that suffering, that darkness for them to do that. And even on a, you know, Brian Greene has some good books on the universe, but it is truly chaos.
I love the man. Order.
He's great. And so it is, you know, it is truly chaos that creates order afterwards. And so it's the hardship
that sometimes creates so much
light. Oh my gosh, Nietzsche's great. He might've been a little schizotypical, but it's all good. He had some good writings.
But Nietzsche did say out of chaos comes order. And I believe that when we get through the zeitgeist of what everyone is thinking and feeling now, there's a gift of hindsight. There's a cleansing of both, you know, not so good. There's a lot of old dying out, a lot of practitioners retiring, sabbaticaling, compassion fatiguing. You know, doing the quiet quitting is another thing. This concept of showing up to your employment, place of employment, and doing the absolute minimal that it takes to not get fired. We're so far on our heels. I think society is ready to rock forward. And I hope that you and I together, through Keystone Total Health in Tennessee, and through the work that you're doing there, and through the Mind Body Center of Florida and the work that we're doing here, that we truly can affect. I mean, I maybe have a little bit greater aspirations. You never want to write a book, you get famous. I don't want to get famous. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy, but I want our message to really reach as many people as possible. and in in a way that affects change, kind of like the difference between Tony Robbins and any self-help guru, you know, the great information. Tony Robbins affects change, like the je ne sais quoi, that extra step and how he does what he does is another thing I've admired in him as well, and kind of tried to model in my own soapbox to patients about why they should do what I tell them to do. Why should I buy what I'm selling? You know, whether that's gratitude, like really take time for gratitude. It's better than any pill I got you, I promise. And you're teaching me a lot, and I hope that I can teach you a lot as well in the future.
I have no doubt. Yeah, I definitely look forward to our synergism, because that's, you know, iron sharpens iron, and that's where it's really at, is a friendship.
Hey, this is YouTube. You can't use words like that.
Touche.
Well, next time, I think we should attack world hunger, probably solve world peace.
We can do that in one episode.
What's that smell in here? Is it my trash can? This is awful.
I'll let you figure that one out.
I got big plans for us.
I'm happy to be on the ride.
Yeah. So now we're gonna try out a new outro. It's gonna be in memoriam of Rich. He and I for years had tried to say 1, 2, 3, be well at the same time. And we never once got it right. And it almost became its own running joke. So I had our marketing people fix it. Thank you, Alyssa, I'm sure. Fix it so that he and I actually say it right at the end together. So to tee up our outro, we will have to end our shows with until next time.
Deal. Until next time.
That's all I got, man.
All right, brother.
Thanks for having me. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah, I invited you. Okay, yeah. Thanks for being here.
And thanks for having me.
I look forward to next time.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Until then.
Be well.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.